Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is the carpe diem moment for libraries right now because we are in this amazing transition.
How are libraries rewriting their story? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
Right now we're holding for 30 seconds, okay?
Guilt or shame down the price.
It's not your ear.
But that doesn't mean that we should just continue on the same course.
The price must be driven down.
People with tone deafness hear just fine.
They send them to the women's bathroom to see an internal medicine doctor.
Well, just wait outside. So
I'm going to give you the red light. When you see the red light,
one of the things that tends to happen with the rank.
I don't have a pulse.
I'm trying to solve the problems that we had 100,000, 200,000 years ago.
I think first we get a system.
That's what I found like on the inside.
On today's show, we're going to explore an institution that's integral to health and science. And if you're wondering why I'm talking kind of quietly right now, I'm at the Free Library of Philadelphia. It's a beautiful, massive old building with high ceilings. It opened for service in 1927. It has a great staircase and wide open spaces. And as we are wandering around this historic location, we'll explore how libraries all over the country are revamping their mission and meeting new challenges. Because when you're looking at a stack of old reference books, as I'm doing right now, you kind of wonder, who needs this? I can just do a Google search if I'm looking for something. Several years ago, Forbes magazine listed the advanced degrees with the worst job prospects, and a master's in library sciences was at the top of the heap. That unfortunate spot has since been claimed by journalism, but that's another story. A new generation of librarians is proving that their knowledge and skill is still very much in demand. Tanya English has more.
To see the rare books and artifacts at Princeton University, you need a key to the locked elevator and an escort.
We are on the second floor of Mudd Library. This is where we house the university archives.
Letters, meeting notes, charters. This is where they keep 270 years of Ivy League history. Mostly it's all on paper, piled into boxes, and those boxes are stacked high on shelves.
But there are some places where even I have to get on the ladder to reach up and get some things.
He is pretty tall. That's 28-year-old Jarrett Drake. He's my tour guide in the stacks.
Here is the Nassau Hall typewriter once used to prepare President Dodd's speeches.
So cool.
Yeah. Who knows, in 100 or 200 years, people will come by and look at a MacBook Pro and say, like, oh, look at that old cool thing. Isn't that so nice? And that's how I get when I look at old typewriters.
Drake is Princeton's first ever digital archivist. He's a librarian who preserves things that were created on computing devices.
The term that we refer to was born digital. Facebook pages, Twitter pages, Word documents, PDFs, spreadsheets, all of these kinds of digital documents.
His job is to figure out how to safeguard ones and zeros. And to do that, he gets help from a $10,000 machine called Fred.
That's Fred's way of saying good morning. We're looking at a forensic recovery of evidence device.
Okay. Looks like a big server to me.
It does look like a big server.
There are a dozen ports on the front, and just beside Fred, there's a stack of cables, firewires, and USB cords to upload documents from just about any kind of computer. The FBI uses the same kind of machine to detect computer crimes, and Drake uses that forensic approach in his library work. He wants to collect without contaminating.
If a book comes to a library, you want to make sure that there's no mold, for instance. There are no bugs or insects. And so a virus scan is a digital version of that.
Imagine the archivist who must have worked here before Jarrett Drake. You can almost see them gently handling the artifacts and rare books. Electronic files get the same kind of care and attention, but updated for the 21st century. Drake protects documents from bit rot, and Fred stamps every file with a digital fingerprint.
Now let's take a look at what a captured Twitter feed looks like.
Some of the science of this work is giving future library patrons access in some of the same ways that the original users interacted with and experienced the digital information.
You can scroll up and down and you can hover over different things and the content is there, right? You see the photographs, you see the tweets, you see the timestamps.
Princeton is collecting artifacts from student activist groups around campus. And in other places, librarians are building digital collections that recognize that someday historians will use social media as a primary source for research.
Especially, you know, when and if Twitter goes belly up and people are like, oh, how are people using records and information in 2015? And like, I don't know, it's 2055. I'm like, oh, there was this thing called Twitter. Like, this is what it used to look like. And people would be like, oh, I was in college when Twitter was out.
Digital artifacts from the online Black Lives Matter movement are being stockpiled by librarians in St. Louis and Maryland. At Brown University and the Bibliothèque Nationale de France in Paris, they're archiving the Arab Spring. In the past, those librarians would have a degree from a library school. But in recent years, many university programs now call themselves information schools. Even when they offer a library degree, lots of iSchools have dropped the word library from their name.
You say, I'm going to library school, and everybody's like, well, aren't libraries kind of over? You know, what are you going to be doing?
Jay Granger is a master's degree student at the University of Southern California. He wears glasses and cardigans sometimes, but he's not too worried about those old stereotypes. He writes online about librarianship, and in one blog post, he said,
we will need to embrace a whole new kind of noise in the profession.
Because, he says, shushing the digital age just gets spit on your computer. Granger says Google can't replace him. It just frees up librarians to help with more complicated information needs.
You're trying to set up someone on the perfect date with the perfect source. That's a great way to spend a day. I love doing that.
Information professionals also see a future helping the rest of us manage our Snapchat stories and selfies. Many people are really bad about downloading that stuff to a hard drive for safekeeping. So we clog up our cell phones and are drowning in digital mementos.
All that ephemera of people's everyday lives may seem insignificant if we're only thinking about one person, but if we are able to collect that on a wider scale, that really gives enormous insight into who we are as a culture, as a society. Just as we study, you know, letters from like 18th century England, that's considered to be important.
That's TK Sangwand. She says today's information specialists work to teach preservation skills to marginalized people so they can build their own libraries.
When people see my job title, they actually misread it and see human rights activists as opposed to human rights archivists, but I actually don't think that they're very different.
In the 1960s, socially conscious librarians began to realize stories are missing from our big institutions.
A lot of times what was deemed important were the records of people in power, and the people who were considered most important were generally older white men. The work that we do does have profound political and historical implications as keepers of the historical record.
So today, librarian activists work to collect other voices. TK Sangwand and her colleagues shared library strategies with local professionals in Rwanda to launch a digital archive based at the Kigali Genocide Memorial. This voice is Josephine Morabowere. In 1994, she was a wife and a mother of six. Paramilitary soldiers herded her daughters, her husband, and neighbors from the Tutsi ethnic minority together on a killing field. Morabowere was the only person in her family to survive. Her story and others are now available on the online digital archive for everyone to hear. Modern librarians are continuing that tradition of providing access, but now their tools are high-tech, and their collections are often born digital. That's the work at universities and special collections, but neighborhood libraries say they're also relevant and as needed as ever. The public library in Collingswood, New Jersey, is exactly what you'd expect. Their circulation desk is right there when you first come in. Director Brett Bonfield says there's also free Wi-Fi and a high-top table where you can set up a laptop.
Just like you'd see in a coffee shop, so that when you look in the front windows from Haddon Avenue, which is our main street here in Collingswood, you see people.
When 19th century tycoon and philanthropist Andrew Carnegie began funding public libraries, the vision was to improve well-being for Americans. Brett Bonfield wants to test that idea.
I would love to know if people are financially literate and if we can help with that. I would love to know if we could do things that would make people feel more engaged in their community and that could show up as voting. You know, maybe they would be more likely to vote in local elections or national elections because of programs we've done or because of collections we offer.
In Collingswood, once a week, there's a story time in Spanish for preschoolers.
Hola, Tomo!
Maybe story time translates to kids who do better in school later in life. And maybe all those uninsured people who used library computers to sign up for Obamacare are actually healthier. Bonfield says the future of library science is figuring out if libraries are delivering on that promise to make communities better.
¿Quién se acuerda de este color? Azul. Muy bien, azul.
For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott, and on today's show, we're taking a look at the changing role of libraries. I'm right now in the rare book collection at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Much of this area looks like you'd picture a library from 100 years ago, surrounded by beautiful old leather-bound books on ornate shelves. There are artifacts and grandfather clocks. A few days ago, in this room steeped in tradition, I met the Free Library's president, Siobhan Reardon, to talk about the future. At the end of Tanya's report, we heard about this active community role that libraries are taking on, and Siobhan said that's key for moving forward.
I have always felt that this is a time, this is the carpe diem moment for libraries right now, because we are in this amazing transition from this transactional organization to something that's more transformational and experiential. And so the more that we can provide programming and information and resources that get to this concept of collective and connected learning, which is how people learn now. When you think about how businesses are evolving and it's all in this very, very open, noisy, conversational type learning, and how libraries need to begin to transition to those types of spaces. So you still have to, there still has to be an homage to traditional learning styles, like a room like this. But in the center of it is this very collaborative civic engagement space, because people choose to learn by conversation and people learn through practicing and doing and watching.
So it goes far beyond research.
Oh. It goes way beyond research. But when that's been the very interesting transition, is how, yes, the research component is still very much a part of our lives, because we still have people who come to the library because they're still studying, lots of students with that practice of how to get at information. Mm-hmm. But it is really this very civic engagement type environment that we're trying to create and allow for going forward, because there really aren't many safe spaces for that conversation that needs to occur, that should occur, and we're trying to create the library to be that safe space.
This library is mm-hmm. in an old building.
Yes.
It's a beautiful old space. Mm-hmm. How do you fit a new modern library
right.
into this space?
So what's been fascinating about the renovations that we have done and are going to continue to do is that you actually, this building, the original architects of this building were actually very forward-thinking people when you think about how it is they created these big open spaces to allow for transformation to occur. And so not the least of which is the upcoming project where we're going to disassemble the stacks. But what's fascinating about the stack system that was built is that it was constructed as an erector set. So it's not integral to the building. So we're going to be able to pull it away. And we're using the stack system as a scaffolding as we begin to deconstruct. And all of that becomes massive open space. We have great images of what it was before and what we hope to return it, what we hope to do with the spaces. But it's been fascinating to see how forward-thinking they were, because in my mind, they built the space for potential change.
You're known in your profession as an innovator. You've been named Librarian of the Year. What do you want to accomplish in the next 10 years, let's say?
Oh, so I would love to, I think it's endless, but I think that from a physical plance, I would like to make sure that our libraries are beautiful, welcoming, civically engaged spaces, and so add much more beauty and utility back to the facilities. We have them, we have to take care of them. So that in 10 years, I would like to see every single facility that we're for which we're responsible is renovated and upgraded and remarkably 21st century in its orientation. But I also want to make sure that our relationship with community is considered just that, that people see that they have a connected relationship with the library and that their input into what we do, programming, materials, and so forth, they feel they have a strong participation in that kind of work that we want to conduct.
Talk about the smell of books.
People love to talk about the smell of books, and of course, when I hear smell of books, I'm like, oh, that's not a good thing. Because when you smell the books, it means the books are deteriorating. The paper's deteriorating. So yes, there's an aroma of books in this room, and it is old, and a lot of it has to do with the bindings. But the books in this room are actually fairly well preserved because we have the right temperature and humidity and climate controls in this room. So you smell it, but not so much. But when people go into a room, like we had in the stacks, and, oh, I love the smell of books, I'm like, that's not a good smell, because you really have to know that that's paper deteriorating, and we have got to get them into a sort of preservation mode fairly quickly.
What are we smelling when we're smelling the smell
of books? So you're actually smelling the paper as it begins, or in the acid in the paper, as it begins to sort of expire. And so the paper becomes extremely brittle.
Siobhan, thank you so much for talking with me.
My pleasure. And thank you for being here.
Siobhan Reardon is the president and director of the Free Library of Philadelphia, and she just talked about modernizing a 19th century building to fit the needs of a 21st century organization. A few miles from here in the northern part of Philadelphia at Temple University, there is a brand new library being built from scratch. And designers for such a modern space have to ask themselves, before they break ground, what is a library anyway? Peter Crimmins reports.
Temple University's main library, called Paley Library, was built 50 years ago. It's really big, about 215,000 square feet. The dean of libraries, Joseph Lucia, says most of it is used for storing more than 2 million books.
It's a big square warehouse with user space at the margins, literally around the exterior of the building on the upper floors, with a big sort of open space on the first floor. You know, in 2016... we don't think of libraries in quite the same way.
There's a new library being built across the street. It's got the same square footage as the old library, same number of books, but instead of 60% of the space reserved for books and 40% for users, the new library will be flipped. Books and documents will take only about 40% of the space, and the lion's share of the real estate will be classrooms, meeting rooms, maker spaces, and digital visualization studios. So how can you cram 2 million books into a tenth of the space? You use a book box. The books are packed inside metal bins, which are then stacked in a matrix 55 feet high, 150 feet long. When a user wants a particular book, Lucia says they will search a database connected to a robotic crane.
They will click a button that says, get me this item, and that will dispatch a command to the software that interacts with the robots. They will activate the appropriate crane to go to the bin where that item is located, pull that bin, bring it to a pickup point where a staff member would open the bin, find the book, and then put it on a pickup shelf.
The whole process takes about a minute. The new library will have 5 of these bays, each with its own automated retrieval crane. The system is based on warehouse technology used by giant retail shipping companies like Amazon. It is not organized by the Dewey Decimal System, doesn't even use the alphabet. When a book is returned to the stacks, the robot puts it wherever is most convenient for the robot.
It goes back to the first available space. Probably, if the algorithm works as I understand it, might be in closest proximity to where the crane is that's going to put it back.
The sound you're hearing is from a YouTube video of a similar robot in operation at the James Hunt Library at the University of North Carolina. The robot does not make room for people in its stacks, but a lot of people like to watch BookBot. The same guy designed the libraries in North Carolina and Philadelphia. His name is Craig Dykers of the firm Snoheda.
you could potentially just bury the technology in the building. No one could see it. But we exposed it. There are two very large windows where you can see its operations, which gets people very excited. The robot itself is painted a kind of very flashy yellow color. So it has a kind of personality that people are attracted to.
The BookBot has got flash, and there are about 40 of these systems online in the United States. But its ultimate importance to the library of the future is uncertain. Printed books are quickly giving away to digital information. So after studying the data, talking to consultants, and asking his crystal ball about the library of the future, Joe Lucia still says it's a $6 million gamble.
That's the real challenge, and this is where we're making what might be considered some expensive guesses, but some guesses about what the relevance of that material is. And this large automated search and retrieval system couldn't, in the end, be repurposable space. That it would, if you needed at some point to remove that expensive equipment and remove that collection, you could, in fact, use that space in other ways.
This is an academic library, which Lucia says is used differently than a public library. Students tend to rely more on printed material than the public. So the new library at Temple will keep 200,000 books out of the robotic system on traditional shelves that can be browsed by hand. When designing a library, Dykers takes into consideration the symbolic heft of standing among collected knowledge 2 million strong.
All great libraries should inspire people. A great building that is a part of the development of culture should manage all the senses and inspire us in some way.
For The Pulse, I'm Peter Crimmins.
Pulse is all about libraries today, institutions of learning which play a huge role in health, science, and innovation. And we've collected your memories and stories from the stacks. Here's Elvira Woodruff from Martins Creek, Pennsylvania.
Years ago, I was going through a divorce. I felt as if my life was falling apart, but I was broke, and I didn't have enough money to get any therapy. Turns out I didn't have to because I got a job in a library instead. And while the pay was low, it didn't help my finances very much, but the library did offer me something far better than any money could have. For 4 hours a day, I found myself wrapped in the cocoon of quiet contemplation and order. It was very much like entering a convent, mostly women employees, all speaking in hushed whispers, with a reverence for order and books that was incredibly soothing to someone like me whose home life had just been blown out of the water. I do believe those 4 hours a day spent keeping books in rows on a shelf gave me more than any therapy could have. So when I hear of someone going through a divorce, first thing I suggest, get a job in a library.
Pulse listener Elvira Woodruff with a memory from the stacks.
Sorry. yeah, this way. Sorry.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Our show today is about libraries, and right now I'm standing in the music section of the stacks at the Free Library of Philadelphia. You can take out a lot more than books here. They have sheet music, CDs, records. Some libraries across the country are taking that idea to new levels as part of an effort to stay relevant in people's lives. A library in Maine lends snowshoes, and another one in Alaska has animal skulls and pelts, and there's one in Sacramento where you can check out GoPro cameras. At the Parish Library of East Baton Rouge, Louisiana, you can take out telescopes, paintings, sculptures, and more recently, Arduino kits. What are those, you ask? Anne-Marie Awad explains.
So first off, an Arduino kit is basically a little circuit board. You plug in wires, LED lights, buttons, and other components in a certain order, and then you plug it into your computer and use code to tell it what to do.
Really, what people do with them is they'll start and go through a little kit that tells you how to assemble some basic projects, gets the basics of circuitry down. things like that.
That's Eric Kahanan. He's a library technician with the East Baton Rouge Parish Library. He's in charge of the 3D printing program, as well as the Arduino kits. He teaches classes on how to use them.
We did one where it was just kind of a free-for-all, play with the kit, learn it, do as much as you want with it. And other times we did specific programs, like they'd follow instructions to build a robot.
The availability of Arduino kits, 3D printing, and soon podcasting and video studios in the EBR library system is part of the nationwide Maker Movement. The Maker Movement is like the DIY movement, but battery-powered. It encourages people to make and invent, and libraries like EBR have hopped right on, developing maker spaces for people to learn and play.
It's a great time to be in the public library.
This is Mary Stein, the assistant library director for EBR. She says neat toys like Arduino kits bridge all age groups, which is something the library aims to do with as many programs as possible.
More and more, the adults would see the programs we were offering the teenagers, and they wanted to come. And nothing kills a teen program more than an adult being in it.
That's why there are Arduino kits to take home, but also classes at the library for all age groups. That's also why the library offers things like adult coloring, podcast listening parties, science fiction film festivals, beer brewing classes. There's even a teen room where there are no grown-ups allowed. Stein calls it a cradle-to-the-grave approach, something for everyone. So I decided to take an Arduino kit home, but later on, after an hour sitting at my kitchen table trying to make one LED light bulb light up.
Okay. Upload. Still not lighting up. I give up. I officially give up.
I guess it's back to the library for me. Maybe for that beer brewing class. For The Pulse, I'm Anne Maria Wadd.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike Inscott, and our show is about libraries today. We're at the Free Library of Philadelphia, and right now I'm standing next to a statue of Johannes Gutenberg, who invented the printing press. He has a beard, he has a long coat, he's holding a book, of course. And these days he might be holding a book of a different kind, an e-reader. Reporter Todd Bookman recently caught up with a man who invented something crucial to that technology, electronic ink. J.D. Albert was just an undergrad at MIT when he had the breakthrough.
J.D. Albert wasn't picturing a flat device with a screen on one side. His initial aim was a product that looked like an actual book with pages, but every page would be its own thin screen. In hindsight, not such a good approach.
Often when you're working on new technology, it helps to really have something bold that you're going for.
While that initiative fell short, the core technology behind e-readers, the electronic ink, wasn't too far off. Discovered in 1997, patented in 99, Albert's e-ink is now the gold standard for just about every e-reader on the market, including Amazon's Kindle. So, how does it work?
When you look in an Amazon Kindle, you're actually looking at millions of tiny microcapsules, which you can think of as a little clear sphere. And inside that sphere is oil, clear oil, and black and white particles that are oppositely charged.
Albert and his colleagues at MIT figured out a way to send an electric charge to some spheres, the opposite charge to others, so that letters would appear in black on the screen. Change the charge, you change the letters. And what's crucial here is that it doesn't take much juice to power the e-ink.
Yeah, so there's a lot of things about the electronic ink technology that are a huge benefit for reading. So one is that it is reflective. So an iPad, an iPhone, any other cell phone, the displays are emissive. They give off light. And that is, of course, in contrast to books and newspapers and paper that use the ambient light in the room. That's what you're seeing.
Another nice feature of the particles is once they're nudged into position by the charge, they stay there with no additional power required.
So a Kindle typically will give you weeks or months of reading time, as opposed to your iPad, which is pretty much dead after maybe 8 hours.
That long battery life, along with the later development of a full color ink, have helped e-readers solidify their place in the publishing ecosystem. There's something like 70 million of them in use worldwide.
To work on something that becomes as ubiquitous as e-books have is a really special thing. I mean, just the other day, I was on my bike next to a SEPTA bus, and I saw a woman sitting on the bus reading an e-book. And every time I see that, I think like, wow, that didn't exist before we made that happen.
Albert, who's now 40 years old, works at the Philadelphia-based product development firm Bressler Group. Later this year, he, along with his MIT colleagues, are being inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame. It's not the Nobel Prize, but it is recognition that his vision for next-generation books has had a tremendous impact on the industry.
You know, our line was kind of that we were trying to not kill books, but kill paper. And our hope was always that this would cause people to read more. It's been interesting to see how both things have happened. People are buying, you know, plenty of e-books. They're also still buying plenty of normal books. For the holidays, I give people paper books. So I like both technologies.
Todd Bookman, great name for today's show, reported this story. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and we're talking about libraries today. We've asked you to send us your memories from the stacks, and here is another one. Sally Keene from Allentown, Pennsylvania, told us about the beauty and challenge of so many choices.
I grew up in a family of readers, but I was never in a library until I was 11 years old. We had plenty of books to read in the house, many of which had belonged to my older brothers and then passed down to me. I loved these books, but they were not my choice, and there were never enough to appease my growing hunger for story. When I was 11, my father retired, and we moved to a farm outside of Annapolis, Maryland. After we had settled in, my mother took me to a library. I was so overwhelmed by it all, I ended up in the bathroom with an upset stomach. My mother was in a rush that day. We had to leave. I could get a book some other day. I was devastated. It's no wonder that I eventually became a young adult librarian. One of my greatest pleasures to this day has been helping a child find just the right book.
Pulse listener Sally Keene sharing a memory from the stacks. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and our show today is about a place that's essential to health, science, and innovation, the library. We've been walking around the Free Library of Philadelphia, and there are a lot of great open spaces in this building. That's something a lot of libraries around the country are doing. They're warehousing less paper and creating spaces for people to connect and learn. One library on Kansas City's east side has dedicated a giant room for people to work up a serious sweat. Reporter Esther Honig takes us there.
On Tuesday nights, this is what it sounds like at the Lucille H. Bluford Library.
Apparently, it's not that packed of a class tonight because of the weather, but this room is easily filled to the rim. It looks like there's at least 40 people at this point.
In a small conference room, a crowd of middle-aged women and a few men are in spandex and sneakers doing squats and bicep curls. The person giving the orders is fitness instructor Nikki Jones.
You would not believe how many people come for all the other things the library offers as far as checking out books and using the computer. And then they see us on Tuesday night. And, hey, what's going on in there? A workout class? Yeah. And so it's popular because of that.
But students like Elena Reed also like it for the convenience.
It's in my community. Like, I could walk here.
Not only is the library on a bus line, but Reed says it's also great if you have kids.
When I come, I have my niece with me sometimes. So she's out there reading books and things like that. So I like that.
Nikki Jones has been teaching fitness at the Bluford Library for 4 years. And in that time, the popularity has grown so much, they've had to add more classes to avoid turning people away.
And I'm talking about, working folks. They, you know, I'm watching ladies get out of their car, running to the bathroom to change into their workout clothes and hit this room for a workout.
This community in Kansas City's east side is nearly 80% African American, and almost 40% of those residents live in poverty. So many don't have the disposable income for a gym membership. And Joan says the high crime rate can make finding a safe space to work out a challenge.
They say, oh, just go take a walk. You know, well, some neighborhoods you shouldn't be walking in. And this would be one.
For Jones, teaching fitness is not about vanity. It's a resource that's transformed her life. And she thinks it can do the same for Kansas City's east side.
This resource is dire to my community. It's because of the health disparities. Hypertension, diabetes, heart disease, the chronic three.
Heart disease, which is often caused by diabetes and obesity, is the number one cause of death in this county at 25%. April Roy, who's been the director at the Bluford Library for the past 3 years, says that health disparity is what drove her to develop new programming.
When I first started working here, I was looking at the Call newspaper, which is our African American newspaper here in Kansas City, and I was looking at the obituary section, and I just kept seeing these people dead in their 50s, you know, over and over again.
Roy says that like a lot of libraries, Bluford is evolving from being just a book warehouse to providing the resources that serve their community. And here, the focus is health. Bluford has partnered with Truman Medical Center and the American Heart Association so they can offer classes in chronic disease management, health fairs, and information on nutrition, Medicaid, and free healthcare services.
So there are definitely some problems over here, but I just sort of look around and I see potential for service. It's sort of the same thing we teach in chronic disease self-management class. I sort of apply that to our entire community to say, well, this little problem we can fix, and this little problem we can fix, and maybe fixing those little things can add up to bigger change.
In the meantime, Nikki Jones keeps everyone's heart pumping.
Get excited, the finish line's really close. You know, a whole marathon's been ran. You gotta get across the finish line. 15 seconds to finish. Let's go, come on, pick them up.
Activity completed.
For The Pulse, I'm Esther Humming.
Libraries on Spandex. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and now a tribute to the traditional role of the library. We've asked you to share your favorite memories from the stacks. Here's Rebecca Vlam of Philadelphia.
I'm the adult daughter of a retired librarian who started her career in a small public library and spent the remainder of her career in a high school library. Beside the gift of the love of books, I adored what is formerly known as the card catalog, the serene and peaceful atmosphere, and the warmth of losing myself in a story. But most of all, I watched and heard about the many, many kids who felt lost or sad or picked on or different come and find solace in both my mother and the library.
Rebecca Vlam sharing her library memories. I'm at the Free Library of Philadelphia today for our show, and right now I'm looking at Charles Dickens' pet raven, Grip. He's on display here. He was rumored to be less than pleasant as a pet, but he's no longer a danger. He's stuffed and behind glass. He inspired Edgar Allan Poe's famous poem, The Raven, and I asked Allison Friermuth from the Free Library of Philadelphia to explain how.
So, Grip was a character study for a novel that Dickens wrote called Barnaby Rudge. In it, there's a man locked in a prison, and Grip the Raven comes to visit him. And he asks, who's going to save me? Who's going to save me? And the raven responds, nobody, nobody. Poe read Barnaby Rudge and thought he could do a better raven character. So in The Raven, his raven says, nevermore, nevermore, instead of nobody.
Thank you so much, Allison.
It was a pleasure.
Allison Fryer Muth from the Free Library of Philadelphia. This pet raven inspired me to think of a library of a different kind located at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia. The fourth floor there is home to 250,000 stuffed birds, one of the largest such collections in the world, including species that are now extinct. I visited Nate Rice. He is the ornithology collection manager there, and I asked him how these birds are preserved.
So when we get the birds, we make an incision down the breast, open the skin out, and take out all the muscles and bones and organs, and then stuff that with cotton. Birds' skin is very, very thin. So unlike mammals, the leather in your shoes or on a jacket that needs to be stretched and tanned, you don't need to do that with birds. As long as you dry that skin quickly, you don't have to use any chemicals. So we prepare the bird, let it dry, and they will last literally for centuries. You know, we have specimens from the 1750s in our collection that look every bit as good as specimens that we're preparing today.
How is this collection used? What can scientists do with all of the birds here?
So that is a great question and amazingly complex. For the first maybe 190 years that the Academy was here, most of the work that came out of this collection was what we call or like to think of as taxonomic in focus, looking at questions to try to understand specifically how certain birds were related to one another, how groups of birds were related to other birds, how individual species or types of birds varied across their range, and just trying to get a grasp on that. In the last decade, two decades, maybe 25 years, that has really changed and broadened. And so now it turns out that birds can be used for all sorts of biological questions. More and more the collection is used for environmental type studies.
What kinds of things can you see from those specimens? You know, I'm thinking now of a hair sample. If somebody wants to do a drug test on me, is it like that?
Yeah, and you've probably seen or heard of some of these type studies with human hair, where you can understand what contaminants are in the human body. Exact same thing with bird specimens. You know, was mercury in the environment in the 1820s? Was arsenic native in the environment? What sort of contaminants were out there?
Does climate change come into play with this at all?
Yeah, so we can get at some of those climate change issues by studying where the birds were collected and what the environment was like at those specific points on the map. A great group of birds for that are the Arctic seabirds. And so we can, based on their stable isotope signatures, sort of fine-tune where they were and know that they were usually living right at the edge of Arctic ice flows. Map that today and see that ice flows are miles and miles distant from where those birds were collected as an indication that the environment has changed.
So scientists can do a tiny trim yeah. on the bird's feathers and then use that.
Yeah, so last year we sent out 60 loans of our specimens to researchers around the world. I think 8 or 10 different countries involved. So last year about 5,000 specimens were sent out on loan.
So this functions a lot like a library.
It is absolutely interlibrary loan. Yes, absolutely.
Do you want to show me some?
Yeah, let's go have a look.
I don't know how you would pick. How many birds are in here?
We'd never finish looking at them all. There's 250,000 specimens, and we'll take a look at a few here. So this is the common bird common hummingbird in eastern North America, the ruby-crowned hummingbird. And just looking at the labels, you can see some are a little bit yellow and older. So this was collected by Samuel Nicholson Rhodes in Haddonfield in 1890. And then here's modern specimens that came from downtown Philadelphia, 19th Street and JFK Boulevard. That hit a window September 13th, 2010. So right there is over a century gap, and you can see many specimens on this tray.
And they are tiny.
Yeah, just a couple inches long. You know, in life, this bird weighed 3.3 grams. So really tiny. I think 4 grams is what you can send first class just with a single first class postage stamp.
And these birds are just on shelves in a...
These are metal trays with a baked enamel finish. So this is a totally inert storage environment. And then the cases are quite high, as you see, and a compressible silicone gasket all the way around. So when you close that door, nothing gets in. No ultraviolet light, no dust, no insect pests.
Let's look at something big.
Okay, so let's go look at some big guys now. These are vultures, new and old world vultures here. So this is a series of Andean condors here.
Wow. So how big are these birds?
They probably stand 3 or 4 feet to the top of their head, but their wingspan is awesome. It's, upwards of 12 feet.
And they have a thick neck. I never realized how thick their necks were.
Yeah, it's massively expandable. You know, they eat carrion, they eat dead flesh, and so they want to pack in as much as they can into their stomach, and then they have pouches to hold more, and so their neck is quite flaccid to hold massive amounts of dead flesh.
How do you think this collection will be used going forward? What do you hope for?
That's the coolest thing for me working here. When I started working here, my whole training, it was just in taxonomy, what we call systematic research. Now there's all this ecological and environmental work being done, and it's impossible to predict what the next step will be. The birds that I'm collecting now, we use them for very specific work, studying malaria and avian influenza and Lyme disease. But 10 years from now and 50 years from now, we have no idea what those will be used for.
Thank you so much for showing us around.
Yeah, absolutely. A pleasure. An absolute pleasure to have you.
Nate Rice is the Ornithology Collection Manager at the Academy of Natural Sciences. For our final chapter of the library edition of The Pulse, let's hear one more memory from the stacks. Here's Pulse listener Pat Brisson from Phillipsburg, New Jersey.
I was working as a reference librarian one day when I noticed a man paging through a volume of a general encyclopedia with a glazed look on his face. "May I help you?" I inquired. "Oh, I don't know if you can," he replied. "I'm looking for information about 2 naval officers who served during World War II, but the problem is that they served in the Japanese Navy." "Well, have you checked the Encyclopedia of Japan?" I asked. "I didn't know there was such a thing," he answered, following me over to the other side of the reference room. "Now, what were their names?" I asked. He told me, and I found entries on both of them without any problem. His jaw dropped open, and he looked at me in wonder. "You're a genius," he exclaimed. I smiled back at him. "No," I said. "I'm a librarian."
Pat Brisson from Phillipsburg, New Jersey, sharing her library memory. And that's our show for this week. We were at the Free Library of Philadelphia, and we want to thank them for having us here. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, our associate producer, Joel Patterson, the managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. If you want to see all of the stories from this episode, we've created a special page for this show. It's on our website, and that's also where you can subscribe to our podcast, whyy.org/thepulse, or you can find us on iTunes. I'm Maiken Scott. Thank you for listening.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.